Okay, well, let's see what's happening anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed in the exact same spot the whole time. They're outdoors, I can say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. All right, Lisa, how are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, this is program 468 in the current series, and as always, packed with ufologically interestings. And in this one, Dave Furlott, a relative newcomer Roger Marsh of UFO Examiner, Area 51 legend Glenn Campbell, some new info from Frank Fascino about his battle with his former publisher, and the always observational Alfred Lemberg. A reminder to you, all that we discuss in this is posted to the UFO Updates list. And the access info that you use to download this program will let you into the list's archive that goes way back to 1996, and it's searchable via the front page. So, let's kick things off with our contributing editor, columnist.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
Ufologists are nuts. Oh, I'm sorry. In today's politically correct society, I suppose I should use the term mentally deficient, or perhaps insane would be a better term. See, ufologists have to be insane because only the insane would insist that something is real after trying for more than 60 years to prove it and failing to prove it to many notable and eminent people and organizations. Not only that, but ufologists refuse to believe the sane, rational explanations that these same notable people and organizations offer up any time something out of the ordinary occurs. For example, the FAA, or Federal Aviation Administration, rationally explained what happened at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport back in November of 2006. The FAA stance concludes that the sighting was caused by weather phenomenon and that the agency would not be investigating the incident. So, any ufologist that points out that there are no known weather phenomena capable of rising up at an incredible rate of speed and punching a large round hole through cloud cover is obviously insane. The UFO updates list also provides us with some evidence of insanity with ufologists because some notable people have been mentioned in recent posts providing very sane, rational explanations why ufologists report seeing unidentified flying objects that ufologists steadfastly deny. A Dr. Edward Strecker came out with a rational explanation for saucer sightings in 1947 while he was the director of the Philadelphia Hospital for Mental and Nervous Disorders. He stated that these sightings were a result of pathological receptiveness. In other words, someone may have seen something like the glint of an aircraft in fast flight and misinterpreted this as an illusion of a flying saucer. He went on to state that illusions were common. Once again, this is proof that ufologists are insane for not believing this very eminent psychiatrist who has provided us with a diagnosis. Also in 1947, a Dr. Harlow Shapley, astronomer and director of the Harvard College Observatory, came to the thoughtful and scientific conclusion that anyone who claims they saw a flying saucer was either neurotic or drunk. Because no evidence that flying saucers are other than natural neurotic phenomena has been received at the Harvard Observatory. Another astronomer, Donald H. Menzel, was also a faculty member of Harvard University, and he offers a number of sane explanations, even after his own UFO sighting in 1949. He saw two unidentifiable, motionless lights in the sky as he was leaving Holloman Air Force Base. He believes that, and I quote, all UFO sightings could be explained by misinterpretations of common phenomena in uncommon seeing conditions. When a report was too outlandish to be accounted for in this way, the observer was simply dismissed as a liar or suffering from mental delusions. So once again, in this situation, ufologists are actually either lying or insane. Pick one. Another reputable gentleman, James Oberg, has offered countless rational explanations for UFOs that have been reported over the decades. There are many rational explanations that Mr. Oberg likes to offer up for UFO sightings, including the planet Venus, the moon, meteorites, and what now seems to be his favorite, Russian space shots or space junk re-entering our atmosphere. He discusses pilots, incidentally, and how they can be wrong when reporting a sighting of a UFO. To quote, two recent test cases are illustrative. The November 5th, 1990 re-entry of the Gorizont Proton rocket body across northern France and Germany, and the January 28, 1994 launch of Progress TM-21. Both cases were observed by airline crews. Arguably, in both cases, the pilots overinterpreted their perceptions and subconsciously introduced deductions and conclusions to shape their remembered perceptions. For those of you shaking your head, he's saying they could not have seen what they thought they saw, and for all intents and purposes, hallucinated because their subconscious minds led them to believe something else. In other words, a little temporary insanity by the pilots and flight crews. So see, here's the crux of the matter. All UFO sightings are easily explainable because they all can be rationally explained. Either the event taking place involved a planet, some other space body, falling space rocks or ice, space junk from Earth, swamp gas, weather balloons, misidentified aircraft like blimps or secret military aircraft, flocks of birds, reflections of lights, drunken binges, hoaxes, or when all of those explanations fail, the people are crazy. Oops, I mean insane. Now, under national, normal circumstances, there can be no argument against such a rational explanation like ufologists are insane, because it follows the same rationale of stating when someone is wrong. There is actually no argument that can disprove such an absolute statement. But as debunkers have discovered, much to their chagrin, they will offer up some crazy explanation to a UFO sighting report, and when the facts are brought forth to disprove their explanation, they change it to something else. And when that's disproved, they change it again, until finally they can fall back on the one absolute. Ufologists are crazy. If following a logical line of thinking, carefully examining reports, viewing evidence, and coming to a conclusion based on all of the evidence, means that the only explanation that makes sense is there was a sighting of an unidentified flying object means that ufologists are insane? Then count me amongst the crazy ones. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
You gotta love those guys with their theories about what it is that we people are seeing.
Oh, yeah. What I love about it basically is, so they saw that. Okay, great. And that's as much of the report as they grab. They don't bother to look into all of the questions that were asked when these reports are put forward. They just immediately go, oh, yeah, well, they saw that. Okay. Well, if they saw that, this is what they saw. Wait a second. How about you go back and you take a look here? If you're saying that they saw that, then they could have only seen that for how long? Well, obviously that went across the sky at a rate of X number of feet per second, and they would have seen it for maybe 12 seconds. Well, okay, explain how come these guys are talking about the fact that they saw it for like 15 minutes. Oh, well, okay, it wasn't that that they saw, then they saw this. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
It's a sliding scale of what people saw and see.
Yeah, and eventually, finally, it comes out to the last bit, which is, oh, well, if they didn't see that, and they didn't see that, and they didn't, well, they're crazy.
Yeah.
That is the final end of it all. And bringing forward, like, psychiatrists and all of these other people who are basically saying that, hey, ufologists are crazy. Obviously, we must be.
Yeah.
Especially if you've got a guy who is in charge of a psychiatric hospital. Of course he's going to be able to recognize crazy.
Yeah. And he doesn't need a board to do it.
No, exactly. What I love, you get somebody like Menzel who turns around and who has seen something, and he's turning around and saying, oh, yeah, well, I obviously saw something that I should be able to identify, but I couldn't identify it. Therefore, it's not a UFO or anything like that. No.
And therefore, according to the other criteria, he's a crazy too.
Yeah, exactly.
Which a lot of people in the UFO field who've been around for years and know who Donald Menzel is would say, yeah, he's crazy.
Uh-huh. And my favorite still is Oberg. I love Oberg because every time he's been called on something, it changes. He changes the story to fit his interpretation.
I guess he has to adopt that position. After all, he's on somebody's payroll.
Oh, yeah. The spokespuppy. In all fairness to him as well, he is doing some really good work and stuff with NASA, but in all honesty, when it comes to that element of it, it's just sort of like, yeah, okay, can you honestly be thinking these things?
I don't know whether these people honestly believe what it is that they pontificate on.
Yeah, not as if every UFO report is a bona fide UFO report. You and I know that. There's all kinds of hoaxes and other crap like that out there.
No, there aren't. They're all real. Honestly, Dave, really.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, that's all of us crazy people would be saying.
And speaking of hoaxes, have you been looking at any of the video that's been linked via the updates list of late?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You see some of that and you sort of go, oh, guys. And the problem is, unless I'm taking it with my own camera, taking a shot of something, I can't believe my eyes anymore. Our technology today is too damn good to be able to put up a shot of a spacecraft landing on the lawn of the White House or the front lawn of Parliament Hill. You can look at it and you can go, wow, that really happened. Well, no, it didn't. It was a matter of CGI and somebody playing around with a computer for a while.
Look at what we do with computers now. The stuff that I use to record us and package this program 10 years ago was $250,000.
Oh, yeah. Stuff is coming down so much in price since anybody and their dog can basically do it.
And they are.
Yes, and they are.
Yes.
And somebody gets on to Photoshop and they go, oh, this is kind of neat, this kind of neat, this kind of, oh, I wonder if I could. They'll sit there and they'll spend 20 or 30 or 40 hours putting together a very, very realistic looking fake image.
Or video and put it up on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff on YouTube, but there's also a lot of crap. What about that Screaming Demon of Mexico video that's around? Have you had a chance to look at that?
Very briefly. It's one of those things where every time I see something like that, I always go back to, I'm a hard one when it comes to stuff like that. You really, really have to work hard to prove it to me.
Jaime Masson, bless his old cotton socks, the Mexican television journalist, has come up with some doozies over the years. Some seem to be okay, and others are
questionable, shall we say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it becomes a situation in terms of, how shall we say, motives. Because it's all a matter of the old story of the theater, putting bums in the chairs.
Yeah.
And how you manage to do that, well, if something is a little bit questionable, well, so be it. But some of the stuff has been interesting over the years, like the military aircraft.
The FLIR.
The whole FLIR incident.
FLIR video over the Gulf. Yeah, well, we've talked about that at length on this program, and there's no resolution to that case.
No.
It's all questionable. Believe nothing anymore, not even what we say on this program.
I think it was Bruce Lee that said it. Believe nothing of what you hear and only half of what you see.
Bruce Lee?
Yeah.
Said that?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if he was quoting somebody else without credit.
He might have been. He might have been, but yeah. I attribute it to him.
That gives us a little more insight into Dave Frelott. Dave, thank you. Good take, as always.
Not a problem.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye for that.
I don't have an eye, but I can get it.
Get it.
I don't have an eye, but I can get it.
Get it.
I don't have an eye, but I can get it.
Get it.
I'm gonna do the best I can.
Roger Marsh is a UFO writer, author, playwright, and he's an independent filmmaker and director of communications for both the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, and ufologist Stan Gordon, whom we've talked to several times on this program. I became aware of Roger recently while gathering material for the UFO updates list, and lo and behold, there is a new UFO news site out there, and I thought I'd give Roger a call and see if we can find out how that came about. Welcome to Strange Days Indeed, Roger.
Hey, thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Examiner.com, I guess, is the home site for UFO Examiner, huh?
Yeah, the parent site is Examiner.com. They're actually in 60 U.S. markets right now and growing rapidly. They're only about a year old, but in each market, they look for people to be writing from all sorts of different topics, from sports and government. I actually happen to be a national editor and the National UFO Examiner, which is just, it's a neat position to be in, to be writing about ufology today there.
For some reason, some people had the feeling that it might be a newspaper out of Denver, Colorado.
Well, they're actually based in Denver, but the company that owns them also owns the San Francisco Examiner. I believe that's where the name actually comes from. But this is an independent company, but it's owned by the same parent company.
And strictly web-based.
Yes, there's no print component to this. It's strictly web-based. This is the future. Future is now.
It's a great idea because I've gone wandering off from the UFO Examiner portion to other parts of the site. Some good stuff on there.
Yeah, there's a lot of great people. I think they're up over 4,000 people writing for them now.
Are 4,000 people being paid, or is it a labor of love?
No, it's actually a paid site. You are paid to write there. It's actually based on the number of page hits that you get.
Mm.
It's how I'm making my living right now.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I had just finished 3 years as an independent filmmaker, and wanted to stay with ufology, so it was a great base for me while I work on books and other projects.
And it's a job that needs to be done. I notice of late that you've been writing up MUFON database reports.
Yeah, that was actually where the whole idea started from. This was in, let's say, early January, and James Carrion, who's the international director for MUFON, had named me the director of communications for them so I could help them with their website for the future. But I was looking for a way to write about the reports that come into their database, which is, it's a 24/7 thing, and it's instant. When somebody files a UFO report with them, anyone going to MUFON.com can see these reports as they're coming in. So the idea was to be the reporter who is out there covering the reports as they're raw and coming in. So I do tell my readers that these are uninvestigated cases for the most part. Probably 90% of all UFO sightings can probably be determined to be something natural or something man-made, but it's, of course, it's that 10% that we're all looking at that could be something else. It could be something extraterrestrial. We don't know, but it's real interesting being there right at the point where you're covering the raw reports. It's amazing how many come in, and it's also kind of neat to be comparing them. I think I just filed a story. I might be slightly off on the number, but I think in the month of April, I had written about 27 different triangular-shaped UFOs alone, just in the month of April, 27 different cases.
Peter Davenport, who runs the National UFO Reporting Center out of Seattle, has complained in the past that people who want to report UFOs don't want to do the whole form, so it's very difficult to get a lot of useful information out of those people. Is the MUFON online reporting form the same as has been around MUFON for years, do you know?
I suspect that they're probably very, very similar forms. I've not seen Peter's form, but I have seen, of course, what people have to fill out at MUFON. And I think that they would, of course, prefer that you do complete the form completely, but I'm sure you could pick and choose what you want to put in to it.
The reason for my question was, are people actually going to great lengths to fill in those forms, or are a lot of them just very sketchy details?
I generally only look at what the public can see. There, of course, is those pieces of the report behind the scenes that only MUFON state directors and field investigators can look at. But I think that most people filling it out do take the time to complete the whole form. Anything that I've seen where state directors have forwarded reports to me was pretty well filled out, the ones that I've seen, yeah.
And, of course, the bane of the big database gatherers is there are so many websites out there who are collecting reports, and they just absolutely go nowhere other than that particular website, and really doesn't fulfill any function other than the satisfaction of the people reporting and the guy who runs the website.
I totally agree with you. In the situation that I'm in, being a UFO writer, people do send me original reports, which I find it amazing and very interesting, but I can tell you that in every case, I ask that person to also file with MUFON. And I think I'm about 90% of what's come my way, they have agreed and gone over to MUFON and filed. But I totally agree with you. There are a lot of small collectors of UFO reports, and if you don't put it all into one spot where we can look at all of the reports together for study, it's really not helping. We really feel that most people don't expect to see a UFO. And when you do, most people are kind of dumbfounded as far as, how do I report one? Of course, the first thing is, should I dial 911? Should I let the authorities know? But I think if you just did a random sample questionnaire to the population, even as big as MUFON is, I don't think that most people would know right off the top of their head, go to MUFON.com.
No, they'll do a search in one of the search engines and then just click the first one and file their report and feel they've done their public duty.
Right, and then that's how reports have come to me in most cases. They've Googled their specific type of sighting, and all of a sudden they see a story that I've written, and they think, well, let's connect up with this guy, which is great. I love to get the reports coming in, get the scoop, get it out there, but of course, always want everybody to file with MUFON.com. whenever possible.
Yes. Your website is examiner.com, and people can get to your portion of the site via that.
Actually, the quickest way I tell people is if you do go to examiner.com, they have a search at the top of the page. And you could either type in my name, Roger Marsh, or you, if you just typed in the acronym UFO, a list of UFO stories will come up, and I'll be in that list somewhere. There, of course, are other UFO examiners related to specific cities. Like there's a Denver UFO examiner, but I would definitely come up in that. The other way to get me is I have a personal website called incahoots.tv. Incahoots.tv. And if you go there, for all of my UFO stories, and I'm also the National Paranormal Examiner also, you'll see all of my headlines for all of my examiner stories on that homepage, and they're all linked right over to the examiner.
I just Googled UFO examiner, and you were the first one there. Bam.
Okay.
Yes. So that's another way to do it. And plus, the listener can always go back to this program's homepage and just click the link there because it will be there.
As I talk to ufologists from around the country, I think most ufologists agree that really no more than about 10% of UFO sightings actually get reported, and that's anywhere.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people out there experiencing who are not filing a report, which is just amazing because as our technology develops, just the use of the web and cell phones and all the cameras that are out there now, there are just some amazing close encounters coming in now. And people are looking at each other and thinking, hey, we're all asking the same question. Are there more UFOs now than there was 10 or 20 years ago, or is it just the technology?
My feeling is it's just the technology.
That's kind of where I lie, too. I think that when you get people talking, I know just people reading my column, they'll write me and say, hey, I had a sighting in 1978 or 1973, back before the technology was booming, back before the internet, where they felt like they had no real way of reporting it. So now those stories are coming out. I, by the way, have a team of illustrators. I've got 4 illustrators right now who work with me. So any of these older stories that are real interesting, I will have them illustrated and then get them up on the site and get the story out there. So a neat way, if people want to write to me and tell me that some of the stories from the past, would love to hear them.
And it's a good concept, too. I like the idea of the examiner.com site. Do you have any new things on the horizon, Roger?
Just recently, we did introduce the UFO traffic report. That's now available every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and it's usually everything that's been entered into the MUFON system within the past 48 to 72 hours, depending on which day you're reading. But I've been so taken back by the witness testimony that's coming in that when you look at it over time, even if you look at just what came in a one particular month, it's just so amazing. And I write these articles about them, the UFO traffic reports. If it's a really, really good story and warrants its own page, I do that. But I'm now leaning back on some of my past work that I've done as a producer and as a director and as a writer here in Chicago. And I'm producing a new feature, which will be upcoming in the next probably 4 to 6 weeks, called the UFO Witness Protection Program. Kind of a funny title to it, the UFO Witness Protection Program, because when you do file a report with MUFON, let's say, you are protected in the sense that your real name and location is not being released. It's just the story, unless you want it to be there. So what I'm doing is I'm bringing actors into my studio, and we're going to take some of these reports that are real interesting, and we're going to take testimony that we think is related. So the first one that we're producing right now, and these will be very short, like 3 to 5 minute films that will be available from my column page or from YouTube.com, but we're going to attempt to pull this off where we have actors actually reading the testimony and, again, putting them together in groups of stories that we think are related. So that's coming up. And I also write comedy as well. Very different than writing straight about ufology, but I also have a thing that I do over at incahoots.tv called Fly on the Wall Web Theater, and it's very tongue-in-cheek, very much fiction comedy, where we claim that we have a device in the studio where we can record short pieces of audio from anywhere on the planet, from anywhere in time. So sometimes when we come upon a mystery or something that we can't get behind closed doors, we don't know what's going on, we invent it. It's just a way of releasing a little steam within the community. And we actually base these on real events, but then we fictionalize them. And the first one up was a November 08 meeting between President-elect Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And it was a meeting that they had in Chicago where everybody knew he was going to ask her to be Secretary of State, but it was a very closed-door kind of thing. And, of course, now through Fly on the Wall Web Theater, you'll be able to hear actually what really happened in that conversation and how it relates to UFOs. So that is the second feature. Anyway, you can look forward to seeing that in the next 4 to 6 weeks. We're actually looking for actors right now, trying to find the perfect voice for Barack Obama and the perfect voice for our Secretary of State.
I wish you good luck with that, or should I say break a leg with that.
Thank you.
And look forward to talking again with you, Roger Marsh. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you so much for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Back in 1996, when I first started the UFO updates list, it was just a list and didn't appear anywhere else. It just went to people's mailboxes. And a man down in Las Vegas somehow picked up on the UFO updates list and suggested that he would host an archive for it. And I was pretty pleased about it, actually. And it transpired that not only would he host the archive, but he had written the software for it. And when I looked him up on the web, I realized that he was Glenn Campbell. And for those of you who have been plugged into the UFO scene for many years will remember the name Glenn Campbell, because he was the guy who did the initial research on Area 51. He lived in Las Vegas at the time. And a few weeks ago, Glenn Campbell emailed me and said he was coming to Toronto, and I thought, wonderful, we haven't seen each other since Mike Woods and our respective spouses were down in Roswell in 1997, and that's where Glenn and I first met. So sitting here with me in Toronto, Glenn Campbell, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me about the early days when you first got involved in looking into Area 51. What prompted that?
I got interested in UFOs back in the early 90s. I had dismissed them all my life. Well, most of my life. I was into them as a teenager. I read all the UFO literature back in the 70s, but what I really wanted then, I wanted them to come down and take me away, and I realized that I really didn't need UFOs. This was just a childish fad, and I passed through it and went on to adulthood. But some 15 years later, I began to be interested in them again. And it all happened when I came across an article on UFOs, and the article had footnotes in it. It had somebody attempting to conduct real research on a subject that I thought was just ridiculous. And that's when something clicked in me. I began to think, wow, this is a really wacky subject, but it's something that could be subject to science, something that could be subject to some discipline. I saw some people climb mountains, some people climb cliffs and test their skills in the wilderness, and I was willing to test my skills in a wacky field of UFOs. It just seemed like an interesting intellectual challenge to try to find some signal in the noise of the UFO phenomena. So I bought all the UFO magazines I could get, and all of them seemed to point to Area 51. The trouble with most UFO stories is you go there and the UFOs are gone. You hear a report, you go there, the UFOs are gone. But at Area 51, you can see UFOs on a scheduled basis. You can go to the famous black mailbox. Certain day and time, you can see UFOs on demand on a scheduled basis. And this was just too good to pass up. I came to Area 51, went to the sacred black mailbox on the Highway 375, and I waited on a Wednesday morning, and just as expected, I saw the UFOs that I'm supposed to see, 5:30 every morning. I quickly came to realize what these UFOs were. They were jets bringing workers to Area 51. Bright landing lights of the jets. So I was dismissing these stories, but for every story I dismissed, a new one would pop up. And one of the lights I saw in the sky was great golden orbs of light that just hovered in the sky for 5 minutes at a time.
And those weren't the planes bringing in the workers to Area 51.
No, these were bright orange orbs of light, brighter than any star, almost as bright as the moon. And these were doing what UFOs are supposed to do. They're hovering in the sky. There seemed to be some sort of plasma field around these great orange orbs that I was seeing. I looked through my binoculars, and I couldn't make out any details. They seemed to skitter back and forth in the sky, and then they magically winked out. So now I had other UFOs to look for. It took me a few nights to figure out what those things were. On the second night, I saw the same orange glowing orbs of light. There were four of them in the sky in a sort of formation, and above each one of them was a stream of smoke going into the sky. So at this point, I realized exactly what these orbs were.
And what were they?
Well, they would have to be either A, they're UFOs that burn fossil fuels, giving off the stream of smoke. But that didn't make a lot of sense to me. What did make a lot of sense to me was burning magnesium.
Flares.
Special kind of flares. Flares that hang in the sky for 5 minutes are not something shot from the ground. They would have to be suspended on something. And my theory at that point was these are magnesium flares on little parachutes. Magnesium burns brightly. It buoys up the parachute and keeps it in the air for up to 5 minutes. So I realized, okay, now there's one UFO I realized was an airplane. Another UFO I realized was orange magnesium flares. As I'm assembling all this data, I realized this is really cool. This whole process of looking for data and analyzing it and seeing what it could be, and that's a pretty fascinating phenomenon. Apart from the UFOs, apart from where it leads, the whole investigation was fascinating to me. So eventually I came out to the tiny town of Rachel. I intended to stay for a month, and I ended up staying 2.5 years.
Rachel is tiny. Where did you stay?
I brought my own recreational vehicle, a little camper. I plugged it in out behind the little alien, and I became the resident Area 51 expert.
The first one?
The first. I call a public relations officer for the base.
In those days, you could actually see the base and what was going on there before the Bureau of Land Management closed the surrounding area.
That's right. You could see the base, but no one was acknowledging the base. It was a phenomenon known to aviation watchers and known to a few UFO buffs, but it wasn't known to the general public. And quite apart from what it may contain, that to me was fascinating. This is something that needs a public relations officer. And I had the time and I had some money and I could come and do that. And I assigned myself as the public relations officer for Area 51. And I was wildly successful.
Was that at the time that you started publishing the Desert Rat as a newsletter?
I happened to land just before the internet became a public phenomenon. So when I first arrived in January of 93, there was no internet. I don't know if many of the listeners will recall this, but there was a time when there was no email. People had to write letters and put stamps on the letters and wait many weeks for an answer to come back to whatever your inquiry was. There were things called books and magazines, and most of the data that we had about something like UFOs came from these books and magazines. I have had the great fortune of reaching the beginning of the internet era. I have landed in Rachel at Area 51 just before the beginning of the internet era. So a lot of what I was doing was adapting to this new technology. So about 6 months to a year after I arrived in Rachel, with no contact but the written word and telephones, email became available. I started putting out an email newsletter about my adventures at Area 51, and this was broadcast all over the world because email was a new thing, and people needed to have something to use it for, and so they subscribed to my email lists. So I could put out an email, and tens of thousands of people would be reading this email. So using these various tools at my disposal, I turned Area 51 into a household word.
And didn't make a penny off it.
didn't make a penny along the way. I came in with some money and I left with no money.
Isn't that the way of this field? Were you the guy who first came across Bob Lazar?
No. The Bob Lazar story began in 1989, well before I arrived there. In fact, in 1989, when Bob Lazar made his claims, I wasn't even interested in UFOs. It was 2 years later that I began being interested and began to look back on the Bob Lazar story and try to crack that story as best I could.
And piece that together with what you'd experienced from the black mailbox
right.
overlooking Area 51.
I seriously believed the Lazar story had credibility. It was the one sane story in all the UFO phenomena, one of the most sane stories I'd ever heard.
What you saw when you were living in Rachel, Nevada, you said jetliners bringing in workers and flares. Did you see anything else that would have given any credence at all to the possibility that there were genuine flying objects hanging out there that were being flown from there?
Personally, no. Everything I saw at Area 51, I was eventually able to explain in terrestrial terms.
Hmm.
So even with that, merely the fact that you can't get in there, that Bob Lazar picked a pretty damn good place to site his secret saucer base because you can't get in there. It's a black box. If this is a smart secret saucer project, they're not going to be visible. And it took quite a while to really crack the whole Area 51 box to figure out what could be there and what couldn't be there.
Hmm. And was it at that point, because I know you said UFOs, the hell with them.
Mm.
Was it at the end of that period that you decided that you were no longer interested in UFOs?
My position on UFOs has been the same pretty much since childhood. I said in childhood that I was fascinated by the UFOs mainly because I wanted them to take me away. I needed the escape. After that, my position on UFOs is not whether they exist or they don't exist. My position is they're not relevant to our life on Earth. So I've moved off of that position from time to time. When I was at, sometimes during my Area 51 investigation, I really began to believe, and I believe that this really could be a real phenomena. But in the end, I always come back to this central issue. They're not relevant to our life on Earth. There's a lot of things we don't know about in the universe. An analogy is trying to explain electricity to the Romans. They would have no idea how our televisions work, how our internet works, how we are able to have an electric light. This was simply beyond the conception of the Romans, but it wasn't relevant to their world. There's always going to be things that we don't understand. The point is, what can we do something with? And the UFOs that we hear about are at least obeying the prime directive. They're at least not meddling with our society. If they abduct somebody, they usually bring them back. So you got to respect aliens like that, the aliens who don't want to mess with our problems.
So you feel that there are aliens visiting us?
I don't know.
Mm.
I don't know. Every story that I've looked at, eventually some alternate explanations come out. Even the stories that don't have alternate explanations, you just kind of throw up your hands and say, well, where can I go with that? I've had a lot of people come to me with very credible sighting stories that I can't dismiss offhand. But the same problem remains. I don't know what to do with that. If I don't know what to do with something, what do? Well, I go back to my life on Earth and live my life on Earth as best I can.
Wasn't it you who put out in one of your newsletters the story of, was it J-Rod 3?
Yes, my old friend J-Rod 3, I gave him a code name, but his name is Bill Uhouse. I don't know if he's alive today or not. He's probably alive, but barely. He would be in his 90s and now. This was one story I thought was very credible. It follows on the heels of the Bob Lazar story after we had pretty much dismissed the Bob Lazar story for various technical defects. This fellow came along and told a slightly different story. His claim is not so much that he worked with UFOs, but that he worked with simulators, that he built and designed simulators to train human pilots to fly alien craft. which makes a little bit of crack sense. If you have a real government program, there are real systems in place to support this government program. And Bob Lazar's claim is that we have flying saucers and we are flying them. And this guy is making a reasonable jump by saying, okay, I didn't work with the saucers, but I helped build simulators to train pilots for these saucers.
Was his claim the same as Bob Lazar's, that he worked in Area 51?
No.
Ah.
His claim was that he worked at Los Alamos, at an underground facility, which again makes a cracked bit of sense. You know, the government, when it has programs, it distributes those programs in different sites. Different sites do different things. Even if you're talking about the stealth program or atomic weapons, there are different sites do different things. You're not necessarily going to centralize everything in one place. His claim is that he worked in an underground facility at Los Alamos where he had one or two of these simulator installations to train pilots to fly these craft. So this opened up a new front in the war. We have to go check out Los Alamos.
So where did these craft come from that Newhouse was simulating?
He was a lot like Lazar in saying he worked in a compartmentalized program.
Need to
and
know.
He knew what he needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how his operation worked. And he said directly that he's seen an alien, that he's been in a conference where an alien was present. He could sketch out the alien that he saw, and the alien is named J-Rod, so which is where the code names for him. And actually, I called him J-Rod, too, because I felt he seemed to want anonymity at the time, so I gave him a code name, and for some reason, J-Rod, too, came out. What was interesting about the Bob Lazar case is his position was he saw certain things. He didn't see anything else. You can't push him off that position. I went here, I saw this, I read this, and no matter what question you ask him about anything else, he'll say, I don't know, because I didn't see it, which is a good hallmark of reality, in fact. If you have an experience, you experience what you experience, and no matter what someone asks you, you're going to say, I don't know about anything else. This is what I knew. And J-Rod, Mr. Uhas's story was similar. He knew about his simulators, and he can draw it out on a napkin. And a friend of mine and interviewed him and talked technically about how this simulator works. And he came up with the right answers, consistent answers, without embellishment, without saying what he didn't know. He says, this is what I worked with.
Virtually word for word is the way that people who've actually been through an experience, each time they tell the story, will tell it. Virtually word for word.
Yes, the same every time. That's the hallmark of reality. That's probably what kept me cracking at this for so long, is that I look not so much for truth, because I'm not, I continue to think UFOs are not relevant. I'm really more interested in a good story. Maybe it's truth, maybe it's fiction, but a good story, Star Trek or Star Wars, you appreciate a good story that's internally consistent. And both Lazar's and Uhas's stories were internally consistent. They were very appealing to me. For a while, I would say that I was an 80% believer in Bill Uhas's story. I eventually pulled away from him, not because the story failed, but just because he became such a jerk. Now, someone may have all the secrets to the universe, but when they're on this planet, I expect them to behave themselves and to talk nicely about others and not to spew racial nonsense. And Uhas just became too much to handle.
Mm.
Not that his story fell apart, but I just didn't want to deal with him anymore.
So in your time at Rachel Nevada and the blackmail box and overlooking Area 51, your feeling is you never saw something that you could not explain.
Correct. Now, plenty of other people came in during the time I was there, saw great lights in the sky, went home totally satisfied that they had seen the UFOs and seen, I'm giving off so much negative energy that it repels all the UFOs, all the aliens, and they stay away from me.
If only it worked that way for everybody, such as the abductees that we've talked to on this program. You got under officialdom's skin down there in Rachel, Nevada at one point.
I never had any direct very little direct contact with the federal government. A couple of times I've actually talked to some of the security guards, but it was very rare. And at no time did I sense any danger from the federal government. They could have been watching me. They might not have been watching me, but nobody has ever threatened me. All my conflicts with authority at Area 51 concerned the local sheriff's department. For a while, the local sheriff's department was routinely seizing the film, anyone who went near Area 51. There's a law in the books that says photography of a secret military installation is forbidden without the permission of the base commander. So if anyone approached the border of Area 51 with a camera, the sheriff would automatically seize their film. So my conflict was there was no case law to support this. How much film are you going to seize? Are you going to seize everybody's film in the state of Nevada if there happens to be a restricted mountain in the background? But this is kind of a dumb local sheriff's department that seemed to be following the instructions of the federal government and seizing the film. So I did have some conflicts. I was arrested in one case where I was in a car where there was some film, and I pushed down the door locks of the car, my famous civil disobedience, and I got a misdemeanor charge on that. So all of my conflicts were with the local rural sheriff's department there, not with the base itself.
So at what point did you finally say, the hell with UFOs, and let's move on?
Well, I think I got married. You have to conduct a real life and take care of a real family. You tend to put aside some of the more vain investigations. Then again, I come back to what's important to me. What's important to me is life on Earth. UFOs are an interesting mind exercise, but they're not what's important in life. What's important in life is living here on this planet in this human body and doing the best you can.
You had the curiosity factor worked out at Area 51.
I think I purged that sort of thing from my system. I guess everybody's got to do it. Everybody's got to go through these investigations.
Yeah. Well, you had a phenomenal website at one point. Now it's a shadow of its former self, but UFO Mind was the place to visit for anyone who was at that time online and wanted to know from UFOs.
Like many a programmer, I tended at the time to bite off more than I can chew. So I started with a website on Area 51, and I expanded it to a website on UFOs, and then I expanded it to a website on all paranormal phenomena, and eventually it became just too big for me to handle, for me to maintain, and I had to give it up. It's something that collapsed under its own weight.
Some of it is still there, though.
The only thing that I've retained of UFO Mind is the Area 51 section. The big thing at the beginning of the web phenomena was Yahoo, which was a hierarchical organization of subject matter. And I attempted to extend that to paranormal phenomena. So from Yahoo, you could branch down to paranormal phenomena. And within paranormal phenomena, you could branch down to telekinesis and things like that. And it was supposed to be this huge hierarchical database. And in fact, at the time, I think it probably was the biggest paranormal database around. But again, as Clint Eastwood would say in some movie, a man's got to know his limitations. And I didn't know my limitations, and I bit off more than I could chew.
Were you still doing it when we were all down in Roswell for the 50th in 97?
I think the site was pretty stagnant at that point. Again, I was being drawn away by family chores, and I didn't have enough time to maintain the site. I think I really definitively pulled the plug on Y2K. I thought Y2K would be a nice, appropriate time for everything to collapse. So at Y2K, I pulled the plug on most of the UFO Mind website.
From 2000 till now, and thinking of, well, U-House, you figure, maybe is no longer with us. What about Bob Lazar? He was at Burning Man for a while, crazed festival that happens down in the desert there. Do you know what Lazar is doing now?
Last I heard, he has an atomic shop in some place in rural Michigan, small town in rural Michigan. He has a shop where you can buy Geiger counters and things like that. He turns up from time to time. He always seems to have a scheme working, some kind of investment scheme, some sort of thing to draw people in. I think he purchased a missile silo near Roswell, New Mexico at one point. They were going to terraform inside the missile silo. He got some investors. I believe one of the investors was William Shatner. You've heard of him. He's a man with great ideas and tremendous technical ability. but maybe not the ability to actually follow through on things. He'll pursue something as long as he's interested, and so then he'll just drop it and move on to something else.
Peter Davenport, who runs the National UFO Reporting Center, I don't know if you're familiar with him or not.
Yes, I've heard of him.
Fork has been around for many, many years. Peter Davenport took it over.
He was around when I was around.
And he now lives in an old missile silo in Washington State.
Ah. I'm sure there must be maintenance issues.
Well, seepage, water.
Seepage, yeah. You know, we don't have the government behind you to take care of these things. They're high maintenance. Missile silos, I think, are high maintenance.
What about Glenn Campbell today?
Oh, Glenn Campbell is living the free life, the life of a vagabond these days. I did get married. I was married for about 7 years, and that ended very well for me and probably well for everyone, but it was a very traumatic event.
Tough time, yeah.
Tough times. Now I'm free of most responsibilities, and I can follow my whims.
You're an international gadabout.
I'm a jet setter, I guess.
a man
of the word. Area 51 is a very good training ground for me for the things that I really do believe in, and that is human philosophy. It's, again, what really drew me to Area 51 was probably not the aliens, but more philosophical interests. I was not interested in the aliens so much as the idea of aliens and what the idea means to us. Probably the most valuable thing I drew out of Area 51 is the notion that we're all aliens. If someone says they come from the planet Zorgon, you have to think, well, where did I come from? And I don't remember where I came from. I remember certain early memories of coming into this world, but I really don't know what planet I come from. Essentially, we're all plunked down here as aliens. We have to cope with the world as aliens. That's what I call the alien metaphor, and that to me is more powerful than anything else I drew from Area 51.
Is that stronger than a metaphor, and you have some sort of sense that at one time humanity was plunked down here?
Well, I think that's irrelevant. I think what's relevant,
yeah,
is that I was plunked down here.
Yes.
I don't know what the hell's going on.
Okay.
Frankly, you don't know what the hell's going on.
True.
Science can explain a lot of things. Science can explain the form of our bodies. Science cannot explain the consciousness that seems to be in our heads. It's something no biology can explain. Nothing that we have on Earth explains my consciousness. It is, by definition, an alien phenomenon. I don't know what happened before to my consciousness. Maybe I was a cow before I came here. Maybe I will become a fly when I leave here. But I arrive on this planet knowing diddly squat. I don't know what the hell's going on. I find myself in this alien body I didn't ask for. I find myself living with these strange creatures called my family. No, that's pretty damn bizarre. And how do I make sense of all of this? And that's the dilemma you encounter with the people who believe they are aliens. You know, I don't belong here. No, I need to go back to my planet. But right now you're stuck here. You have to make do with what you can here. We are all essentially aliens dropped on this planet who have to learn to cope with what we've been given.
As Mike Woods once said, what's interesting about UFOs and the aliens is not what it says about them, is what it says about us.
I always interpreted Area 51, for example, as a great Rorschach test. Mm-hmm. People see in this ink block test what they want to see, and that was true of Area 51. You'd have conspiracy researchers who say, oh, there's a vast conspiracy here. They're abducting babies and turning them into food for the aliens. You have the abductees who believe this is the center of some energy vortex or something, where there's a lot of peace and love being emitted from Area 51. People see in Area 51 what they want to see. And that, to me, was as interesting as the base itself. There was maybe two inquiries here. There's the inquiries to figure out what's at Area 51, and there's the just standing back and recording all of the stories of all the people who come here. And that to me, was sociologically interesting. It was very revealing of the people who come here, not so much the base itself.
What would it take to suck you back into being interested, seriously interested?
If the government came to me and said, oh, we can give you a tour of Area 51, I might take that tour. Maybe if there's a free lunch involved, mm-hmm, I might take that tour.
And yes. What about UFOs in general? Would anything pull you back?
my time on Earth is limited, as it is for all of us. I'm looking at the time I have left and trying to make something of that time. Right now, and probably for the rest of my time, UFOs are not high on the agenda. If there were an announcement tomorrow, yes, there's an alien base on the moon, yes, they've been visiting us for years, I'd watch CNN intensely for a couple of days, and then I'd go back to my regular life, because my regular life is here on Earth.
You've been shooting some wonderful photographs around the world, places and people. You're writing a blog on a regular basis.
I'm producing an awful lot.
Still being as creative, if not more so, than in the days of your Area 51 work. Is that what Glenn Campbell sees as the ultimate task in his lifetime?
If I'm lucky, I've lived half of my lifetime. I've collected some experiences. I have some philosophy. I have some ideas about how life works. And I want to make those available to the next generation. I want to express my experience to the next generation. It's a natural thing to do. And that's chiefly what I want to do now. I've got things to say, and I want to say them, and I got to get them out fast before I get snuffed off. And once I get snuffed off, you know, they can do whatever they want to me. If they want to send me to another planet, that's fine. That's not my affair right now. Right now, I have to deal with the planet Earth as it is.
Glenn Campbell, 2009, a long way from 1992, 93, 94.
That's a long way. My hair has gotten way gray, yeah.
Glenn, let's talk, as we wrap it up, about your website and your blog and Facebook even, because you're on there as well.
So I'm a social media maven. I have perhaps a dozen websites and several blogs. Whenever I have an idea of any kind, I have a medium to express it in. So I write songs, I write screenplays, a philosophy newsletter, and all of these can be found at glenncampbell.com. And that's Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, dash, Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L, where you can find all of that.
You've always been an intriguing man, whether you realize it or not, to a lot of people out there. And I've had more than a couple of people ask me over the years, what the hell happened to Glenn Campbell? He disappeared. And now we know some of the reasons why.
I feel like Spinal Tap. There's the scene in Spinal Tap. They're listening to their own song on the radio, and the DJ comes on and says, that was Spinal Tap, now residing on the Where Are You Now file. Where are they now file? But I'm on tour, you know. I haven't really left. I'm here all along.
Yeah, it's just people need to know where to tap into.
Right.
Glenn Campbell.
GlennCampbell-.com. That's about as close as I can get.
Glenn, thank you for this. It is good to see you, and look forward to your next trip to Toronto.
Okay, we'll be back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My flying saucer, where can you be? Since that sad night that you sailed away from me.
Frank Fascino has been on this program more than a couple of times. He's talked about his Flatwoods Monster book and Shoot 'Em Down. One of the things that we didn't really discuss, other than to say that there were a couple of UFO author researchers that felt that the Flatwoods Monster book was a little inaccurate. How did you manage to handle that one, Frank?
Well, what basically happened, Arrow, is the original manuscript of my book, The Braxton County Monster, was edited several times. And where the problem came into play was after I gave the final okay for the book to go into print, it was up to my satisfaction and came out, and I was not aware that the publisher had edited the book at least one more time without my knowledge, and the book had 150-plus mistakes in it.
Whoa.
Yes, documented.
So he had sent you the galley proofs before they were to be printed.
Yes, we were actually working back and forth together, sending me what he had worked on. I would go through it and said, this must go in. And I would send the corrected versions back. And this went on for a couple months. And when the book got to the position where I thought it was fine, the book went into print, but I was unaware that the book went into a final edit without my knowledge. And the book came out, and it was basically chopped to pieces.
And how did you discover that?
I found this out when I was on book tour from the people who were coming to me, buying the book, listening to me on the radio shows, and they were coming back and following me on my tours. And basically, it was, Frank, we heard you talking on the radio about this part and that part about the Flatwoods incident. How come you didn't put that in the book? I said, yes, it's in the book. Of course it is. That's a major part of the story. And they would say, well, show me where. And they basically would go through the book with me. And that's when I found out that the book was chopped up to pieces. And that's basically how I found out. I was totally unaware of it.
And presumably devastated.
Yeah, devastated, Arrow, and quite embarrassed that this had happened. Even though it was not my doing, it's still embarrassing to have your readers and fans telling you stuff. And it's just beyond the chopping the book up. Maps were mislabeled. Stuff was out of sequence. There was typos. And Stanton Friedman, who endorsed the book, actually had worked on it with me. And just little stupid things like Stanton Friedman's name was not at the end of the foreword.
No.
The lists were incorrectly numbered. Key points were edited. Air Force bases were put in that shouldn't have. Terminology. It's a tough book to edit when you're talking military terminology, so you just leave it alone. You don't go in and edit terminology. And that's where I caught a lot of flack.
And this is after years of research into the book to get all your facts.
It was 12 years to that point.
Ugh.
And the last couple years, Stanton worked on it with me. You know, I wanted to get all my ducks in a row. And when you're dealing with military, government documents, UFO conspiracy cover-up, then you have to be very tight and right on the ball. So Stanton Friedman was proofreading, going through everything with me and talking on the phone 1,000 times a month, making sure we had everything right. And then when it went into print, it was just massacred.
And you were a publishing neophyte. Presumably, you had no idea of the trouble that you could get into using the publisher that you did.
Well, what happened is this book, because of the way that the contract read, very simply, I was tied to the publisher, and this book could have went on forever being published incorrectly, Errol. And that's what aggravated me. The book and the readers deserved more than to have a piece like this. So what I had to do was I filed a lawsuit against the publisher of the book, the company, and basically we sued to get the publishing rights to the Braxton County Monster book back. And after several years, my attorneys just contacted me, and everything has been authorized. And I have the publishing rights back to my book, and the digital master print plates were ordered destroyed by the court. So right now we have a new edition of the book.
Which presumably you've been waiting for a decision as far as the lawsuit was concerned.
Yes, this has been tied up for quite some time. This has actually been going on for several years. And I have a new team of attorneys, and my promoter, Mr. Larry Bailey in Charleston, West Virginia, was helping me with the whole process, and we finally got it back.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It feels good to have the right back to it. And when the book comes out for this second edition, Errol, it's going to be the way it was intended to be. It's corrected. And since the book has come out, there's been some new revisions, some new witnesses, new details, so I've updated it simultaneously.
Are you going to put something on the cover of the new version of the book or on the back of the book so that when people who bought the first edition will know that this is the book the way you actually wrote it and not the way
The
first publisher decided to put it out?
Absolutely. That's being drawn up, but I'm very happy about it. There's actually some photographs and new maps, new illustrations in the book. I have approximately 800 maps, photographs, and illustrations, Errol, that I had worked on. And they're put together in a collection, and some of the pictures that went into the book, I thought other things would be more suited. So this time I have a little bit more control over the whole situation. And I'm keeping a closer watch on it. But this is the book basically the way I was intended for it to come out.
I look forward to seeing a copy of that. And there are one or two UFO authors, researchers, whom you might want to send a copy of it to, just to clear things up.
Absolutely.
And once everything is straightened out as far as the legalities of this settlement, then perhaps we can talk about it a little more fully.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We're not making this up. It was filed through the Kanawha County court system in Charleston, West Virginia. And it's all out there. It's legal. And here we are about 4.5 years of dealing with this, and we finally got the book back. And I'm looking forward to it coming out, and the public can actually read the way this book was supposed to have been done.
I bet you do.
Yes.
Now, you have a couple of other books in the works, too, right?
Yes. I have another book I had been putting together. It's called The Flatwoods Monster, From Myth to Reality. And I go more in depth in this book about the historical account of the Flatwoods Monster incident, and I go into the September 12, 1952 UFO flap. So it's going to be two different books. Same general topic, but in the second book, the Myth to Reality book, I go more into what happened that day. There was 21 hours of sustained UFO sightings around the United States in 102 locations. I have probably everything on the planet to do with the Flatwoods Monster incident. And, you know, there's personal interviews. I used past researchers' notes, books, magazines, newspapers, Blue Book, old 1952 maps, flight manuals, anything and everything on the planet I could get my hands on that tied onto this one particular incident is in this book. Whereas the Braxton County Monster book, the first one, I go into a different area of what was happening regionally throughout the state of West Virginia. So they are two different books, and they have different interviews in them. Both of them are going to be gems when they come out, Errol. So I'm at 18 years now, 18 years of research on this one particular incident. I'm working with the town of Flatwoods and Brothers Bailey Productions in Charleston, West Virginia, and I'm going to be present for a three-day event in Flatwoods. We're bringing the story back home. We're going back into the mountains of West Virginia, and we're going to do a three-day monster festival. And we're actually going to have eyewitness Freddie May, Alfred Lemberg, and myself, and we're going to bring all of my research of 18 years into the town, and we're going to set up a monster museum.
And that's happening this coming September?
Yes, sir. The 4th, 5th, and 6th. And I'm going to be showing my video documentary. I'm going to have a little slideshow, a lecture. And what we're going to do that's never been done before in the general public, we're actually going to have guided tours throughout the area of Flatwoods that were involved with the incident. And we're going to have eyewitness Freddie May, who actually saw the craft and so-called monster, because now we know, we found out through my research, it wasn't a monster. It was a metallic probe that was approximately 12 foot tall. So what we're going to do is we're going to hit different points of the town, and we're going to explain what happened to each of the areas and tie it in, and we're going to have an eyewitness who actually was there. One of my other favorite reasons for going into West Virginia Flatwoods is the gray country cooking up there, Errol. You put on 5 or 10 pounds every visit. You know, we're going to have a monster parade for the kids, so it's going to be a good family event. They're great people up there. I love working with them. After all of these years, they had to be vindicated of being made a joke out of by this story. Between the government and the different people who laughed at them, I kind of dug through all of that, and I'm able to show and prove that this was not a 12-foot-tall monster wearing a dress, as the public has been told for so many years. And it's amazing, too, Errol, working with the younger generation of kids, they're more open-minded, and that really sets me back. I'm amazed by that. You're talking kids 5 to 10, 12, 13 years old, early teenage kids, looking this thing, and it doesn't even really scare them. I think there's more scarier things out there on cartoons than the Flatwoods Monster. And the kids look at it and go, wow, that thing's pretty cool. It's a space probe, huh? It looks like a robot. It wasn't a monster in a dress. And when you have a little kids bringing that point up, it's like, boy, you could see what happened with the press and the way everything was set out of tune over 50 years ago.
We talked about that in previous programs, and I encourage the listener to go back to the website, to virtuallystrange.net, where they grabbed this one from, and grab the others if they haven't heard them. They're well worth listening to Frank Fascino and Stan Friedman a couple of times there, too.
Yes, Stanton was actually up in Flatwoods a few years ago. Stanton liked the story working with me while we were doing the first book, but when he went up there and walked onto the site and he looked around, it all fell together for him. He really understood what was going on. It made sense to him. That's why he stepped forward and he really endorsed the first book. But it was just a tragedy that had to happen, but I can't dwell on it. I'm just going to have to keep moving forward and forget about the past of what happened with it and get the two new books out and people could read what actually happened on September 12, 52.
Once the whole story comes out, let's have you back and let's talk about it some more.
Oh, I'd love to do that, Errol.
Okay, good.
One of my favorite shows.
We'll talk again soon then.
Okay, very good. Thanks for having me on, Errol.
Over. Congratulations on getting the
Thanks again, back. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good feeling to get it back again.
Till next time, Frank.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's been a while since Alfred Lemberg and I conversed on this podcast. We're going to remedy that right now. Head down to Alabama, to Enterprise, Alabama, where indwell Alfred Lemberg.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm looking forward to another opportunity to explore the aggregate extraterrestrial hypotheosis.
My God, if I were paying you, that would be $30 right
now,
there.
No, at least.
Oh, I can hear a cash register ringing somewhere in the distance.
Yeah, don't we all wish it would? Mr. Campbell put the nail on that head, indicating that he arrived in ufology with some money, and several years later he departed minus all that money. So, got to be a cash register ringing for somebody, but it's definitely not me, and it's definitely not him.
Along with his interest in it all, it seems.
Yeah, which really bothered me a little bit. I was unsettled. I was nonplussed in his response. I'd like to say at the outset that he seems like a fine man and a wonderful guy and focused, serious, intelligent, somebody that you'd like to live next door to, but I was a little bit unsettled by his take on departing ufology.
Actually, me too. It was a surprise to me that he had quit. Although, when you look at the number of people who have apparently quit the field in the last few years.
But never seem to actually come across and do that, it seems.
Well, I don't know who you're talking about, but I know
Don Ecker. Yeah, he's been talking about leaving now for how many months has it been? I think it's coming up on a year now anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacques Delay, he seemed to make every indication that he was finished with it, and he's popped back up. This is hard to walk away from, man. It's the whole rest of the universe. How do you walk away from the whole rest of the universe?
By going deep, deep inside yourself, I think, is the way some would describe it.
Yeah.
Which Glenn Campbell seems to have done.
Yeah, I was intrigued with his whole story, talking about how in the early days in UFOs, he was interested as a teen, and he was really kind of interested in the escape that they provided, and that he coming right out to say that he would like them to come down and take him away. That it was a childish fad at one time. And then he gets hooked by an article that has footnotes indicating that someone's really trying to put some professional interest into UFOs, and that brings him back. I'm reminded of curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought him back, you know?
Time will tell whether Glenn Campbell stays away or not.
Yeah. He made every indication of, okay, I was out there, I saw UFOs, and I went out to investigate them, and, I saw these UFOs, and it turned out to be employee aircraft, okay? That's now an IFO. And then he talked a little bit about those strangely employed orange orbs that are trailing smoke, and I was reminded of Lynn Katai and the whole Phoenix-like affair, but they're dismissed as flares. So bim, bam, boom, right off the bat, I went, I looked. I think he said on a couple of occasions that everything that he looked at had a prosaic explanation. I think that's pretty fair, isn't it?
Yes, that's fair, and hence, on top of all the things that he was going through in his personal life, which he also touched briefly on.
Yeah, I have no idea what was going on there, but the thing is apparently he did have something going on that drags you back to the real world, and he was very insistent about that, too. A couple of things really intrigued me about his story is when he drives out to the little alien just outside Area 51 and hauls up in his little trailer, plugs in, and assigns himself as the public affairs officer for Area 51.
That was funny. Yep.
That blew me away. What an occasion. What an opportunity. And another thing that really got me about him, too, was he was in at the beginning of the Internet era. He was right there at the very, very tippy top. And I got to wondering, did he in some way perhaps help define the new approach to UFOs all by himself? Because UFOs didn't take off until the Internet happened. And then it occurred to me that maybe it was he that provided the format and the flavor for all newsletters and UFO lists that would subsequently follow, and that he was the first to use email and start getting this wide band distribution of information out to the public about UFOs. All of this stuff going on, and inasmuch as the Internet is driven by UFOs and porn, did he help create the Internet with the interest in UFOs?
Perhaps he helped create the interest in UFOs via the Internet.
Yeah, but the point is he was the guy that was right there fanning that flame and provided pretty much the venue for everybody else to kind of climb on board, if they had any sense, up to a point and including yourself. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
1996, I had started the list at the beginning of 96, and Glenn Campbell started archiving at UFOmind.com the UFO updates list in December of 96.
Yeah, and I think it can be added, too, that he was the one that turned Area 51 into a household word. I think back to my first indication on somebody getting email on a message board on a computer, and I read it, and, oh, what's this thing about UFOs, and having an idle interest from when I was a kid, flipped into it and started reading about Area 51, and boom, that's got to be him. He's the guy that was there to start.
He dragged UFOs out of the BBS, the bulletin board system messaging, into the new world of the Internet and the World Wide Web.
Yeah, he really ought to have a place in history for that, is my thinking. Then he goes on, and the rest of his expression and his explanation seems to make me begin to wonder if he is indeed a debunker, if you will, and I'm using that pretty broadly, but a debunker of UFOs and Area 51 as, and I quote him, not relevant to human life on planet Earth.
I don't think so. I think that's just the way he has evolved his feelings about both himself and UFOs.
Yeah, but so much of it bothered me after that when he said, talking about electronic lights, computers and radios and TV and what have you, are so far beyond the Romans of that time, it would have no relevance to them. So by that same token, an alien's technology will be beyond a human appreciation and irrelevant to humanity. I immediately took issue with that because, man, it remains. You know, the Romans would learn to use it quickly because they were a pragmatic, materialistic people. And essentially, it remains that we're the Romans, too. The aliens are us, perhaps. He also said that aliens are, reason not to look at them or be worried about them or be thinking about them, is that they're in no way meddling with society. They put abducted people back. But I've read Richard Dolan and his UFOs in the National Security State, and he makes every connection and indication in hundreds of footnotes that, man, I mean, aliens are very definitely meddling with humanity in all manners of ways and on all sorts of levels. And then there's Mack and Jacobs and Hopkins. There's Robert Hastings and UFOs and nukes. Every indication is that the aliens meddle with humanity. That's a reason to get interested and pointed about looking for them right there.
But when you've developed a philosophy that says the hell with UFOs, then that pretty much puts up a wall for oneself, does it not?
There's no argument there. I guess questioning respectfully the validity of the personal wall that he's put up, especially given the contributions that he's already made to what's going on, his contributions to the whole consciousness.
Thank God that not all the researchers and investigators have adopted the same attitude toward UFOs as Glenn Campbell has.
And again, I don't know how you could, given that it's the whole rest of the universe, but many of the things that he was talking about, I'd already made the indication that he said straight out that, man, everything that he looked at, and he said it with a degree of honesty that you have to appreciate, but everything that he's looked at has an alternative explanation. All of these things, Bill Uhouse and the J-Rod 3 and all that stuff on the heels of Bob Lazar and UFO simulators. But then he says something like, he doesn't look for the truth. He just wants a good story that is internally consistent. That really bothered me.
Isn't that the way science is supposed to be?
What, not looking for truth, just looking for a story that's internally consistent?
Well, if it's internally consistent, then it's truth, isn't it?
I don't know, I can't say, but then I look at internally consistent stories like Lazar and Uhouse, and admittedly the jury's still way out on both of them, but again, for real good reasons, their stories don't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm being too hard on the guy, and I certainly don't mean to, but the reports that he made with regard to being in that area so long and never having any real trouble with the federales or local police outside of that one occasion when he was arrested for his little bout of civil disobedience there. That was pretty cool. Yeah, Dan, what are they taking the film for, man? That's beyond insentient. He said that Area 51 was kind of one of those guys that when you have to make the choice between living a normal life and not finding out about what you should know about, not pressing forward. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a little older than him and getting close to the end of my life. I'm looking back now more than I'm looking forward, and I want it to have meant something. And finding out what's up there, it would seem for me, given that I have the time that I've already admitted to, that I make something like that happen. And maybe help other people along that path, too. Campbell said a man has to know his own limitations. And he said that referencing his first UFO website, which got so huge and everything, it just collapsed under its own weight. I think he meant that on a few more levels, too, and it's apparent that he's kind of bounced up against one of his limitations, and that was family and a desire to have some kind of a planned future. So I kind of wonder, does Campbell dump on ufology as he's going out the door here, and couldn't he allow that, okay, he couldn't come to grips with it, but that others really should continue to press forward and expand horizons as long as it suits them? Because this UFO thing just can't be ruled out in the final analysis for a whole bunch of good reasons, and many quality people are saying so. And that ufological reality seems to have the potentiality of holding so much potential, if that made any sense. He said that Area 51 was a Rorschach test, and that people saw what they wanted to see in it. And I have to allow, sure, that might be true for some, but I resented it a little bit because, you see, I suspect my culture is being something less than forthcoming with me as an individual. And I look for evidence that supports or discounts that basic premise. I don't want to see what I want to see at Area 51. I want to see what is. To the point of that six levels of evidentiary reality that I'm always on and on about with regard to the history and the photographs and the anecdotal and all of this stuff, quality stuff, the physical, the artistic, and the personal, but those six levels. And what I think that they're pointing to is a treasure house of evidence abundantly extant. It's all around us, and it's begging for an audience. And I think we ought to give it that audience. And I think we need that to have us as a humanity continue any kind of elevation or advancement or progression at all. I just think it's important to us as a species. And it just bothered me a little bit that Campbell can walk out looking over his shoulder, giving the indication that, hey, you folks are wasting your time. Well, I don't think I'm wasting my time.
And neither do I.
Well, thank you very much for that, Errol. Your external validation is always important to me.
Perhaps you could say that with a little less sarcasm. that's Glenn Campbell nicely packaged a la Lemberg. How about Roger Marsh?
Yeah, Roger Marsh, killer guy. I didn't know too much about him. I was vaguely aware of Examiner.com, and it wasn't just until I was hearing him speak that I went over there and had a look at it, and it seems like pretty much of a quality operation. I was impressed. So let me get this straight now. That is the new UFO touch site, but the new site for MUFON Grande? You know, the big one?
It's a good dissemination site, I think, for MUFON information.
Do you think this was funded perhaps by Mr. Bigelow?
Oh, I doubt it. Although he's spending money in other areas, as in Bill Dolman's Roswell dig evidence that came to light and listeners can read about on the updates list. They have found some sort of tiny artifacts, presumably, if there was a crash at Roswell, missed by the troops who were in there cleaning up the debris. Not a lot of understanding of what those little tiny fragments are, apparently.
Mm. It's a Roswell dig. They dug something up on the ranch. I want to look at it, you know. I was a little disheartened to hear that people aren't filling out the forms the way they should when they're trying to report UFOs, and I'd like to caution everyone listening to, folks, see a UFO. But okay, he couldn't come to grips with it, but that others really should continue to press forward and expand horizons as long as it suits them. Because this UFO thing just can't be ruled out in the final analysis for a whole bunch of good reasons, and many quality people are saying so. And that ufological reality seems to have the potentiality of holding so much potential, if that made any sense. He said that Area 51 was a Rorschach test and that people saw what they wanted to see in it. And I have to allow, sure, that might be true for some, but I resented it a little bit because, you see, I suspect my culture is being something less than forthcoming with me as an individual. And I look for evidence that supports or discounts that basic premise. I don't want to see what I want to see at Area 51. I want to see what is, to the point of that six levels of evidentiary reality that I'm always on and on about with regard to the history and the photographs and the anecdotal and all of this stuff, quality stuff, the physical and the artistic and the personal, but those six levels. And what I think that they're pointing to is a treasure house of evidence abundantly extant. It's all around us, and it's begging for an audience. And I think we ought to give it that audience. And I think we need that to have us as a humanity continue any kind of elevation or advancement or progression at all. I just think it's important to us as a species. And it just bothered me a little bit that Campbell can walk out looking over his shoulder, giving the indication that, hey, you folks are wasting your time. Well, I don't think I'm wasting my time.
And neither do I.
Well, thank you very much for that, Errol. Your external validation is always important to me.
Perhaps you could say that with a little less sarcasm. That's Glenn Campbell nicely packaged a la Lemberg. How about Roger Marsh?
Yeah, Roger Marsh, killer guy. I didn't know too much about him. I was vaguely aware of Examiner.com, and it wasn't just until I was hearing him speak that I went over there and had a look at it, and it seems like pretty much of a quality operation. I was impressed. So let me get this straight now. That is the new UFO touch site, but the new site for MUFON Grande? You know, the big one?
It's a good dissemination site, I think, for MUFON information.
Do you think this was funded perhaps by Mr. Bigelow?
Oh, I doubt it. Although he's spending money in other areas, as in Bill Dolman's Roswell dig evidence that came to light and listeners can read about on the updates list. They have found some sort of tiny artifacts, presumably, if there was a crash at Roswell, missed by the troops who were in there cleaning up the debris. Not a lot of understanding of what those little tiny fragments are, apparently.
Mm. It's a Roswell dig. They dug something up on the ranch. I want to look at it, you know. I was a little disheartened to hear that people aren't filling out the forms the way they should when they're trying to report UFOs, and I'd like to caution everyone listening to, folks, see a UFO. Your name is not going to be used. report. If we're getting thousands of these things across the United States, someone's got to wake up and talk to Congress about it. Attention.
If hundreds of thousands of reports have not prompted Congress to hold another set of hearings on the UFO, then I doubt any substantial database is going to convince them to do so again.
You're right. But a man's reach must exceed his grasp or what's a heaven for, period. The ufological record over time as he is witnessing it is really astounding to him. An indication there that something was really going on, that was really being seen by real people all over the United States, and it was personally affecting him. That's the impression that I got.
You have to bear in mind, too, that he's a relative newcomer to the field, was a filmmaker originally.
Uh-huh.
And now that he's able to access the MUFON database and see all of these reports, it's, oh my God, look at all of this. It's confirmation of perhaps his suspicion over the years that something was going on, and I think that's what evokes that reaction in him.
Well, I hope it fuels his enthusiasm for a while because it's infectious and I like it. I love that little device of faking anywhere in time and space that he was going to do with actors.
Mm-hmm.
What a great idea that is. I'm really looking forward to that when he does it.
Yeah, me too. Good observations on Roger Marsh. Shall we move on to Frank Fascino before we run out of megabytes on this drive?
Oh, we certainly can. The report that he has gotten his book back is good on all manners of different levels. Good for a revealed history of American servicemen who would have otherwise just been forgotten and disregarded. It's good for the families of those men. It's going to be good for a whole town of people in Flatwoods, West Virginia, who were ridiculed unbearably since 1952. It's good for an aviation history that is revealed, and it's good for a history of war that has never been revealed before. And I'm just so pleased that Frank is going to be able to tell the story as he told it and meant it to be told before it was butchered in that errant publication that it was butchered in.
Caused him a lot of grief among some of the senior researchers, authors in the field.
Exactly. It's unfortunate that that happened, and I'm hoping that he takes you up on your suggestion to mail the two offending individuals concerned a copy of the real book the way it was supposed to be written so they can have an informed opinion. It's really unfortunate that two of the lights in the field were so immediately against Frank's book based on essentially what was a mistake, not his own.
It wasn't a mistake. It was a deliberate slashing of huge chunks of the book, as Frank said, 150 errors that he tried to correct.
Yeah, deliberate and horrific. I think everyone is certainly going to be made to understand, if I have anything to do about it. What Frank approved to be published was not what the publisher executed. And that was the deal they had on paper. That has to be true because it's why Frank has been successful in getting his book back, successfully completing the suit. And it's a book which is very popular in West Virginia, and the publisher was loath to give it up. That's a story that's going to be told as time goes on, because it's starting to heat up just now, and it's going to explode, I've got a feeling.
And I trust that Frank sends a copy of the judge's findings, which forced the out-of-court settlement, to both parties who poo-pooed the book and dumped all over Frank.
Yes, and iterate the specific and egregious errors in the publication of that book that pretty much destroyed Frank Fascino, and I think it's a credit to his story and his tenacity and his honesty and integrity that he has been able to come back.
Absolutely, yes. Well done, Frank.
Yeah, well done indeed. And that's about all I have.
Alfred Lemberg, as always, much appreciated. Bye, Alfred.
Bye-bye, Earl. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for your interest and the use of your ears. And remember, keep an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. Till the next time. Bye.
This edition of Strange Days Indeed. Oh,
hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.